Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
Laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Support for this podcast comes from Frito-Lay and the 2023 Snack Bracket Championship. The Frito-Lay Snacker Challenge is underway, and fans are voting on their favorite snacks to crown champion. We're talking about primetime matchups between the best 64 snacks in the land. Will Ruffles Ridges reign supreme? Can Doritos defend their dynasty? Or will Smart Food use their smarts for a surprise upset? Only you can decide. Get in on all the action for a chance to win up to $1,000 or a year's worth of snacks. Let your snacks be heard. Just go to Frito-LaySnackIt.SBNation.com to vote and enter for a chance to win. No purchase necessary. Sweepstakes ends April 3rd, 2023. Void where prohibited. Year's worth of snacks awarded in the form of 52 coupons, each good for one bag of chips. See official rules at Frito-LaySnackIt.SBNation.com.
Welcome to this week's edition of the NinersNation.com Better Rivals Podcast. My name is Oscar.
My name is David.
And this week, it is episode 2 of Smart Football Month. I'm warming my hands over this burning LeBron James jersey. And Zach Robinson, senior analyst at Pro Football Focus, joins us this week to talk all things quarterbacking, as that is what this episode is going to cover. We're going to dive deep into how you grade quarterbacks, how you separate a quarterback from scheme, and all manner of interesting things about learning a system very similar to Kyle Shanahan's system, because Zach Robinson played quarterback in Cincinnati under a Gruden and runs.
Is he the lesser Gruden still at this point?
I'm pretty sure that the weightlifting nephew.
I don't even know that he qualifies to be the lesser Gruden.
I mean, that's exactly why he's the lesser Gruden, because you think just by reputation, name, and size alone, he should be one of the bigger Grudens. His name is Deuce Gruden, by the way, in case you weren't familiar with this.
Never a more apt name.
Oh, man. And he's like a professional weightlifter. And he's like, I don't know, 5'1 and a half, 300 pounds. The dude is, he's basically like from his ankle to his chin, he's just one giant neck. That's all it is. It's just neck. So, yes, I guess you could say that of the Grudens, he's the lesser of the three. But let's get to the rundown, because not a lot has happened, but one thing that is kind of a big deal happened, and that's that Reuben Foster was fined and suspended without pay for the first two games of the 2018 regular season for violating the NFL's conduct and substance abuse policies. So can't say it wasn't expected, but was it as bad as you thought?
No, I think that's, like, all things considered, based on where this could have gone when this whole thing started, right? You know, focusing purely just from a football perspective, like, two games, I think, is pretty reasonable. And the 49ers got to be kind of happy with how that worked out. I think four games seem to be kind of like the expectation for whatever reason for a lot of people. I don't know. Four games seemed like a decent number based on what was going on. But yeah, I think you're, you know, it's two games against two pretty good offenses. Obviously, you'd like to have him out there for the Vikings and Lions and going against those teams. But yeah, I mean, to get him on the field, hopefully for 14 games after that is pretty good.
And really what the NFL to me is saying is that he's like just a game worse than groping an Uber driver. That's the context I'm putting this in, right? So,
I never try to make sense of those and compare them to it because there's no method to the madness.
It's ridiculous. I wonder if he would have pulled a Jameis Winston and like apologized to Goodell if he could have gotten it reduced to a game and a half. Just come in after halftime. Why not? Just break all precedent.
I mean, it was pretty telling, right? That they came, like both Foster and the 49ers were like, yes, we'll take it. We'll take it. This is great. He's going to do it. There's going to be no appeal. Like, yes, this is fine.
Yeah, I would have thought that they would have tried to appeal. But honestly, John Lynch is probably looking at Reuben Foster like, you were going to take it and you're going
to
like it.
Yeah, like you're lucky to still have a job. So yeah. two games is probably pretty reasonable.
Yeah, exactly. So it sucks not having a player like Reuben Foster. But all things considered, it could have been much, much worse. The only other story is an ESPN story where they put together a list of the five most important players on each team for 2018. And these are the five that Nick Wagoner listed for the 49ers. Jimmy Garoppolo, Richard Sherman, Joe Staley, Solomon Thomas, Jerick McKinnon. David, do you agree with that list? Is there anyone you would change? What would you do with that list?
I don't think it's a terrible list necessarily. I would only probably keep two of those players, I think. If I were going to build that list, Jimmy Garoppolo, of course, is going to be number one. There's not really a whole lot to discuss there. But of the other four, I think Solomon Thomas is the one that makes the most sense to keep because I think, you know, obviously a big thing was made this offseason about not really fully addressing edge rusher. And he's the one player, I think, with the ability to potentially take a large step forward in that area and produce kind of more than what they had last year at that spot. So I think, you know, his improvement in year two is going to be very important. But the other three are, I think, a little more iffy, and I think I'd probably go some different directions.
Yeah, I totally agree about Solomon Thomas. I think, to me, he's the player. That tweet was kind of going around, like, name the one player you expect to take a leap in 2018.
Right.
I kind of think Solomon Thomas is that person. I do. And I hope that he is. And
hope it is, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's more of a hope than a think, and I'm trying to disaggregate the two in my mind. But I do think that everything is pointing towards him getting better in year two. Now, how much better he gets, of course, is the part that's left to be determined. But if he can turn into a solid producer of pressure, especially off of the edge on base downs where he's playing a weak side defensive end spot, that could be a boon to this defense, and it's going to be great. So if those are the two players, what are the other three that you throw on there?
So I would go with an offensive lineman, but I'm not going to go with Joe Staley. Only reason being is because I think with him, there's less uncertainty involved with it, right? I think you kind of know what you're going to get with Joe Staley. Is he an important player? Of course. But I think how good that offensive line ultimately is this year isn't really hinging on Joe Staley, right? It would be a very surprising thing if he just kind of fell off a cliff and was a terrible player and wrecked that offensive line. The bigger thing in for them taking a large step forward this year, I think, is going to be the play. It was tough to choose between, I think, Weston Richburg and Mike McGlinchey. I think those are certainly two. I would probably lean toward Weston Richburg just because I think he's going to have a larger impact in the run game. And then hopefully he can kind of help with the guard situation and kind of help that whole interior be a little bit better this year. So I would go with him as the offensive lineman. And then I would probably go to defense and looking at coverage, you know, with those other two spots.
Yeah, for me, it's Adrian Colbert.
I think is definitely on there. You know, safeties, you could really go with either safety, I think.
Yeah.
You know, they both kind of have a little bit to prove there, but Colbert, yeah, totally makes sense.
I think Tart, just because of what he's been able to do so far, he's, you know, I think he's a year, this is what going to be his third year in the league. I feel like he's a bit of a known quantity, more of a known quantity, if not not a known quantity entirely, but he also is going to play more in the box. And the player that makes this defense go is going to be that free safety. And if Adrian Colbert can turn that small sample size of production into a full season's worth of production, that's going to be great. But if his play starts to dip and suffer, that's a big part of the defense that's not playing up to par. And you might think the team has, you know, the opportunity to switch to someone like a Jimmy Ward, but that then changes whether or not you think about re-signing Ward if you've got to bench Colbert. And I think a lot of things happen once the whole Colbert thing gets figured out. But I hope he continues to play at a high level. I think he will. But I think that is more important than, say, like Richard Sherman.
Definitely. And I think, yeah, I mean, at corner, I would stick with the secondary for that final player. And while Sherman, I think, makes sense, I don't have, a lot of issue with that. Obviously, there are some question marks with Sherman and his ability to come back, at 30 years old off this Achilles injury. Like, there's definitely a little bit of uncertainty there. But to me, I would replace him with Akella Witherspoon. Just, again, for kind of a little bit of similar reasons to Solomon Thomas in that, I think how big of a step he can take in year two is going to have such a huge impact on how good this secondary and how good this pass defense can actually be this season. So I think I'm going to lean a little bit younger there in that potential for some significant improvement in year two over Richard Sherman. But I don't really take, issue with either one of those guys.
And so who's your fifth player then?
Wait, isn't that it?
Oh, did you do two guys?
I think so. I think Garoppolo, Thomas, Colbert, Witherspoon, and Weston Richburg.
Okay, so yeah. You did both Witherspoon and...
both of them.
Yeah, and I'm going to go with another coverage defender, but I'm going to go with Kawan Williams. Kawan Williams, not sure.
Kawan sounds right.
Kawan sounds good, yeah. He's someone who had a better end to the year than he did at the beginning. Another player that is, he's basically a starting corner at this point. And in that interior of the defense, you're really hoping that he can continue that trajectory of getting better. And if you think about the salary that he's on, you think about, again, Jimmy Ward being the first guy off the bench, even though I guess just Jeff Hafley doesn't want to call him that.
So I think that was going to be my one kind of question there for you is that spot, again, no issue with looking at that spot and not being in an important position this season. Are we sure that Jimmy Ward isn't going to be in that spot come week one?
I don't know. So I guess maybe I would put like the Madden kind of silhouette dude, whoever is the nickel
sure.
corner,
yeah.
Whether it be Williams, whether it be Ward, I probably lean Ward at this point. I think he's probably just a better player at the corner spot over the, but I mean, Williams is someone who's got a history with Hafley and they brought him in specifically for this role. They re-signed him, even if they didn't re-sign him at a huge dollar amount, not a dollar amount that's significant if he ends up being a bench player. But I think that nickel corner spot is more unsettled for me, given the competition and given how important that player is.
Definitely. I mean, we know that coverage in the middle of the field is super important, and having somebody who can come in there and be a quality player is important. Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting. I mean, obviously they're pretty set at the moment on giving Jimmy Ward a run at outside corner. I just find it hard to believe that he ends up as a starter at that spot, barring injury, right? Barring Richard Sherman not being ready or something happening to Akella Witherspoon. It just seems like it would be a surprise. So I understand, like, at this stage in the game, wanting to get him, more reps there and getting him reps in the system on the outside. That all makes sense. But ultimately, again, you're looking to get your best players out on the field, and I'm not convinced right now that Kawan Williams is a better player. So I think that we could see, if Sherman's recovery goes well, continues to go well, and everything's all right there, I feel like at some point in training camp and preseason, we're going to see a shift with Jimmy Ward going back into the slot.
All right, well, let's get to the interview this week. We're going to bring on PFF's Zach Robinson to continue our Smart Football Month. One of the things we wanted to do this month was really dig into the quarterback position, especially since we have a young quarterback who is developing and is new to the system. And we thought to ourselves, there's a lot of this whole Jimmy scheme versus not scheme debate had us thinking there's a lot about quarterbacking that I think is misunderstood. And it'd be great to have someone who's played the quarterback position at a Power 5 school and now grades quarterbacks basically for a living to come on and talk about what that is and what that looks like. So Zach Robinson, he was a 3-year starter at Oklahoma State from 2007 to 2009 under Mike Gundy. I think he can confirm whether or not Mike Gundy was a man. He played with the likes of Kendall Hunter, Des Bryant, Brandon Pettigrew. He was selected by the Patriots in 2010 as a 7th-round draft pick. Kind of bounced around the league a little bit, ended up with Cincinnati and Jay Gruden, who runs, of course, a similar West Coast system to Kyle Shanahan. So now he is a quarterback. He spent some time as a quarterback coach and a consultant, and he's a senior analyst at Pro Football Focus. So let's go ahead and kick the interview off with Zach Robinson. Mr. Zach Robinson, it's good to have you on the Better Rivals podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, fellas, appreciate you having me on.
So Zach, in a kind of quirk of small world history, which I guess is not small because of football, I actually watched you play live in Stillwater in 2009. I, being of the Longhorn variety, went to a Longhorn game and saw you go again, go up against Colt McCoy. And
was it the 2000? It was the 2009 game.
Yeah, wasn't it? The 08 game was the game where you came to UT, but the 09 game was the year after that, where it was in Stillwater. That game was not nearly as good.
Absolutely smoked us.
Yeah, yeah,
I do remember that game. I wish you would have came to a better game, man. That was not the best.
Well, from my perspective, it was a great game.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But yeah, you guys had Earl Thomas. I just remember all the guys on defense just looking across the ball like, oh boy, it might be a tough day here. And you guys, that was the year, that national championship year, right? Against Bama.
Yeah. So yes, I think it was. Yeah, it was. Sure. And I've always been curious, actually, what it's like to go up against a defense like that, because that defense, that Texas defense, was no joke. And that game, I think you ended up throwing three picks, two of which were returned for touchdowns. What's it like?
For the reminder.
Hey, man, that's what I'm here for. That's what I'm here for. I'm curious what it's like to look across the field at a defense like that.
Yeah, it was good. You know, all the DBs I remember being good. They had. Obviously, Earl Thomas was the man. I mean, you knew that the way he could see things and dissect what we were doing. We ran one play early in the game to where he was mostly playing slot defender against us, and I think for a lot of that year even. But, you know, we ran one play, and we converted a third down where we kind of gave him a different look, and we threw it underneath him, and he barely missed the play. And then we tried to come back and run the exact same play. He showed the exact same thing that he did on the previous play, recognized it, turned around, intercepted the ball, ran it back to the house. And I was just like watching it on film the next day. I was like, man, like his instincts and the way he reacts and like diagnoses plays. Obviously we see him do it in the NFL all the time, but it was not easy looking across the ball and seeing all those dudes over there. That's for sure.
Crazy. Well, we'll talk a bit more about some of this stuff when we get to a lightning round at the end, but let's talk about your life in the NFL, because you're drafted by the Patriots after that season, actually in 2010, and you're a seventh round pick. You kind of go from a team to another, and you end up in Cincinnati, and you end up running an offense much like Kyle Shanahan's offense here in San Francisco. So being a 49ers podcast, we're obviously interested in what that life was like. And you know, you from the different systems you've experienced, whether it was spread in college, the Pat system, or the West Coast system with the Bengals, how difficult is it to really pick up that West Coast system as compared to the other ones that you had to pick up in your life in the NFL and college?
Yeah, no, it's definitely difficult. You know, I think when you think of West Coast, you think of a very wordy, complex in terms of just calling the play that, you know, everybody's seen on TV, John Gruden calling out a play, and it's, you know, 15 words before you get everything out. But it's a great system because you tell every single guy what to do within the context of the play. And it's all on the quarterback to, you know, to have all that stuff memorized and then spit it out as confidently in the huddle and get guys on the same page and, you know, believing that, hey, this is going to be the best play we've ever ran. So that was what I learned the most, is that the verbiage and getting it down was definitely tough. But the beauty of it is, hey, the X receiver is going to know his job. All I'm telling him, basically, I'm telling the Y, I'm telling the Z individually throughout the play. So that's the beauty of the system. Once you can master that language, it really flows together. And honestly, it was by far I had the most experience in it, but it ended up being my favorite system by far.
What do you think is the most difficult aspect? Because you've got protections, you've got of course the routes by basically individual person, you've got formations, you've got motions, you've got tags. Is there any one part of learning the verbiage or system where you were like, man, that took me a while, or did it all just kind of come in spurts at you and just end up coming together?
Yeah, it was kind of the spurts. I think, you know, in a lot of systems, they will tag, you know, a concept that will be on one side, or, you know, I was in the number system as well. So, you know, a five routes, a comeback, a six, you know, so I think, you know, learning just the routes and how all that was flowing, the formations was fairly easy to pick up. That's just strictly a memorization thing, but, it definitely takes just, you know, some extra studying of how to spit out the play, where on other offenses, you know, you might just have five words and it's all encompassing on some of the route structures and everything. But, man, it, you know, if you can master it and get it down, it's definitely has advantages.
So I think a lot of fans like recognize, right, like you mentioned with Gruden spitting out these like 15-word play calls, and they kind of at least have a general understanding that that language element of the West Coast system is very difficult. But is there anything that you think that kind of, I guess, like the general public or like any general misconceptions about the system that people kind of tend to get wrong?
Yeah, I think the term West Coast system was, and I think maybe it's gotten a little bit better, but it's always been viewed as like quick passing game, and this guy will fit in the West Coast system because he's a quick passer and they get the ball out. And yes, there is elements of that, just like there is quick game elements in a lot of offenses, but the design of the offense and the ones I've been in has been the misdirection, the play action, getting chunks down the field. We got the quick controlled passing game, but really it's a an offense that any QB can fit in, not just kind of a quick timing and rhythm passer. So there's a lot of great stuff with it, and I think that maybe some of that's been stomped over the last 5 years or so in terms of a West Coast quarterback being a guy that can just dink and dunk down the field.
Do you think that has more to do with the language of the verbiage that's used, or do you think there's something about the systems that's uniquely different? Because we're seeing like a big convergence of the types of plays that you'll see across the NFL. The concepts are not really all that different. They're just dressed differently. And then you've got how those things work together, which is what Shanahan and McVay, I think, do really well. So do you think that a lot of that kind of West Coast is inherent in the verbiage, or do you think there's something unique about the system that makes it West Coast?
That's a good question. I think, in terms of the flexibility that the quarterback has at the line of scrimmage, I can speak for the two West Coast. I was in Seattle as well with Jeremy Bates, and that was, as West Coast as it gets. And I did feel like you had total freedom at the line of scrimmage, to get into the right play. And most of the time it was, hey, if we can throw the ball, let's throw the ball. Let's not just check away a run away from numbers. If the look is good to throw, let's throw. And it felt like it was, in terms of that, it was an aggressive style to where, the quarterback's making the last check at the line. And there might be some systems where we won't fix the protection all the time, but, we want to throw hot. This was, hey, let's fix the protection. Let's get into our best play possible that we see against this look, and let's go attack.
How difficult is it nowadays to really improve as a backup quarterback in the NFL under the new CBA? I think you had the good fortune of playing kind of on both ends of the CBA, right? Where I think your first season was right before the lockout year, and then after that, you've got all these practice restrictions. One of the things that we talk about a lot on the show is like just the issue of repetitions. When you're looking at a player to draft and develop, you're looking at a finite number of reps in practice, and it's not easy to develop if you're not getting starters reps. So how's it difficult from a quarterback's perspective?
Yeah, no doubt. You nailed it. It's, the term developmental QB it's not even a term anymore because you don't get to develop these guys. So I definitely got to see both sides. The most reps I ever got was, like you're saying, before the CBA 2010 when I was with the Patriots. We had a ton of extra practice time. We had two-a-days to where they would give just me an entire period to run and the threes, an entire period to practice our offense. And so that just doesn't happen anymore. And you're looking for a developmental third quarterback. You're looking at maybe getting – you're fighting for routes on air reps, to be honest. And to get like a team rep in practice – maybe you get like a couple a week, during the season, you'll probably get zero, but, in training camp, you'll get, a couple here and there, but, it's too bad that that's the way it's kind of, obviously the players gave up, or wanted more freedom and more free time and everything. But, for the bottom of the roster guys, man, and developmental QBs, it's definitely tough.
Well, let's go ahead and actually get to one of those quarterbacks that's had to, had to spend some time with the Patriots trying to develop as a backup quarterback in that new CBA, and Jimmy Garoppolo, of course. So I think let's kind of start easy, start general. What were your kind of overall impressions from him during those five starts last season?
Man, I was really impressed. I've always been a guy that's been I've always been a fan of his game. He just He just has kind of the look and the instincts and the feel for the game, all that stuff. And I think his arm is definitely developed, and you've seen it, you know, last year especially. He's got just such a natural knack for playing the position and you know, extending the play, getting the ball out on time, playing within the rhythm of the offense. And then his play under pressure last year, I thought was pretty good. The Bears game sticks out. I know there's a bunch of throws in that game where guys are barreling down on him, and he's hanging in there. He's hitting digs over the middle of the field, and you saw some of that stuff, and it was easy to get excited, you know, right away, because he has a ton of game, you know, the great feel for it, and quick release, as everybody, you know, has already seen. But man, it was impressive to see just how quickly he could, you know, ignite that offense and just be in there a short time.
Now, you do all the eval for Pro Football Focus. So you watch all the quarterbacks, you grade their snaps. What would you say was Garoppolo's most glaring deficiency in his game last year?
Yeah, I think, you know, the 20 plus plays and the downfield shots, that needs to come up a lot more. You know, there was a lot of sustaining drives and you know, he racking up, you know, 8 yards, 10 yards, 12 yards. I think just alleviating some off the offense and getting some chunks down the field, you know, especially in this offense off of play action. I think that's the one spot where you're like, okay, he's done all this stuff really, really well. An uptick in kind of the downfield accuracy and downfield shots, I think, will be big.
What do you think was the reason that he kind of struggled on those throws? Was there, I mean, I know it's a pretty small sample to work with at this point. I think he's got, what, like 16 of those deep ball throws there from last season?
I'm going to need you to make a declarative statement about his future forever with certainty on 16 throws right now.
16 throws. But I think he only completed like four of those, right? So, I mean, obviously it wasn't the most encouraging first 16 throws there. So, was there anything that stuck out just with him, in whether that's like from a mechanic standpoint or some sort of like deficiency there that may have led to some of those struggles and that something he needs to kind of clean up going forward?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think there's, you know, he's got such a quick release and he's used to just snapping it off so quickly that maybe sometimes he doesn't always get through the throw. And it's not saying you got to like baseball pitcher, get your right leg up and over, but kind of bringing your hips all the way through and really finishing the throw on the deep balls, I think is maybe something he's seen and worked on. I'm not sure, but it, you know, from watching it on film aspect, you can definitely see like, hey man, just get through that throw a little bit. And, you know, some of those won't float as much and maybe have a little juice behind it.
So when you think about his throw quality, and you mentioned earlier about how you'd like to see him get a couple more chunk plays within the offense. Of course, the big topic this offseason was Jalen Ramsey talking about Jimmy Garoppolo, saying that, you know, it wasn't really Garoppolo that beat them up all that bad. It was the scheme. I'm curious where you fall on that spectrum and whether or not you think you're able to separate a quarterback from scheme in the way that Jalen Ramsey is kind of saying you can.
Yeah, I didn't agree with that at all. I mean, he diced him up with his accuracy and knowing where to go with the ball pre-snap, made a few plays, you know, extending the play. So I think that maybe just a little bit of sour grapes from his part, but, you know,
sticking with the quarterback tribe. I like it.
Exactly.
Quarterback stick together.
You got to stick up for your guys. But, you know, separating a quarterback from scheme, yes, it is tough because game to game, there's games where, you know, it's schemed up perfectly and you've got open throws at the, you know, you've got the defensive look that you're expecting and you're getting that, you're playing in rhythm. I think a big thing that we're trying to track now is just, you know, quarterback's rhythm and you know, how well they're staying in the flow of the game and what's causing them off rhythm, whether it's pressure or coverage or a combination of both. So it's difficult to do. I do think that, you know, those games where it's tight coverage and we track, you know, tightness of coverage and accuracy and all that stuff. And that's going to be kind of ramped up even more this season. And hopefully we'll be able to separate some of those where you're saying, hey man, this guy had 60% of his throws into tight coverage this game. You know, no wonder he had a little bit tougher time or didn't complete as many balls or whatever it may be. So that's the $1 million question though, man, is just separating QBs and scheme. And it's definitely not easy.
Would you say it's a fair presumption that if a wide receiver is running wide open and in a wide open space, that that scheme that's getting him open. Unless, I mean, there's obviously route separation and stuff like that. But if he's running free and there's not a defender in sight, is that the scheme at work? Is it a fair assumption?
I would say that that's a fair assumption. A quarterback's on typically his first hitch, maybe his first or second hitch, and there's a wide open receiver. You would think that that's some sort of scheme related, and you know, coverage busts on the back end, or just a look they weren't ready for. So you look a lot at their feet, and if they're, you know, staying within the rhythm of the offense in their first and second hitch, and they're throwing to open guys, then I think a lot of that's definitely scheme related.
Definitely. So I mean, one of the things that hit on there, right, is this idea of throwing to open receivers, throwing to receivers who are in tight coverage and all that. I think during this whole conversation, one of the things that is kind of tough for your average fan to really pick up on is what's expected from these quarterbacks, right? Something that PFF talks about a bunch, and that's kind of like the basis for how they go about a lot of things is what's really expected. But 49ers fans are sitting there and saying, like, look, yeah, he's thrown to these open receivers, but Brian Hoyer and CJ Beathard couldn't throw to those same open receivers. So he's got to be doing something right. Right. So I think what is exactly the job description for an NFL quarterback when you're watching these guys on tape? You know, what is it that they should be doing? Even though we all know that it's very difficult, everything that they're trying to do and handle is incredibly difficult. But what's kind of that baseline? What are you expecting them to be able to do?
Yeah, that's a good question. And we found with, you know, in terms of it's always hard because you're trying to figure out what their read is, what, you know, how are they getting through progressions? You hear that out so much. So we kind of been able to look at a lot of that stuff. We found that quarterbacks throw to their first read 65% of the time. So I think when you're looking at that, it's like, okay, if he's throwing to his first look, he's got to be accurate, you know, and so we can separate the accuracy that way. Anything past that, you know, we talk about quarterbacks' processing ability, and guys are just naturally more gifted in being able to turn a read down and smoothly while staying in the rhythm of their drop and getting their second hitch, third hitch, and staying on balance and being able to deliver to those second and third options. And then the thing that I always look for is just the ability to extend the play, you know, whether it's in the pocket like Tom Brady, outside the pocket, like Aaron Rodgers, Russell Wilson, or, you know, combination of both with Roethlisberger. And you know, Garoppolo's got some of that where he can just extend and feel the pocket. Those are the main things, you know, the pocket instincts, the old Bill Walsh. I mean, 49ers, if you look at anything that he's ever said about evaluating quarterback play, the number one thing that you always see is pocket instincts. And he talks about it. And those guys that just have that innate feel for it, they could, you know, have less maybe arm talent or something, but if they've got a natural feel, then they're most of the time going to be able to find guys, within the contract or context of the offense and, you know, throw the ball accurately.
So
I know that was a lot. That was kind of a lot there.
No. It's all really good, right? So I mean, basically, it's being able to throw to your first read if they're open, but then if it's not, then to move through your progressions and do that smoothly and in rhythm, and then, you know, kind of evade the mayhem that is the pocket in the NFL to make a successful throw.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious whether or not, like, if we go back to the idea of a wide receiver being open, this is a question that, like, it might sound, I don't know, it might sound like overly reductive, but I'm legit curious about it. If there is a wide open dude, is the expectation with Von Miller breathing down your neck, and not even breathing down your neck, but just in an NFL pocket that's super crazy with the mayhem and the disguise and everything, that you do complete that? If you're in a quarterback room with Tom Brady, is it like, I don't care if you're the seventh round pick, you're making that throw because you're a quarterback?
Right.
Or is it like, well, we get it, right? That there's, you're not always going to make those throws, and it's not expected that you're always going to hit that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the depth of that throw definitely takes into account if it's a, you know, 20-yard seam route and you've got a guy that's legitimately hitting you as you're throwing. Yes, but it's expected to where if you've got enough space, a little bit of space in the pocket to where your arm's not being affected at all, you know, these guys, you got to be able to just basically turn and rotate in the spot where you're at right now. There's no following through on a lot of these. You're expected to just be able to turn, rotate, and as long as your arm is not getting hit or maybe you're getting bumped on the side, you're expected to make those throws. So You know, the pockets seem, you know, we talk about O-line play and how much it's changed over the years. And if it's worse now, you know, those guys up front are coming, and you just have the space in the pocket is something that you always see where you're like, man, I don't know how this guy got this throw out. You know, Tom Brady's obviously a master at it, but, you know, I think that's definitely a good question. I think that's kind of the best way to look at it.
So you mentioned something interesting there, you know, about a quarterback's ability essentially to have to stand in that spot and just kind of rotate the upper body, right? Not really be able to get all the way through it and have those kind of like perfect ideal mechanics when you're getting the ball out. I think that's another area that is kind of tough, right? For like an average person to be able to look at is what a quarterback's doing mechanically. I think a lot of people seem to have this idea that there is like this perfect set of mechanics out there and that every quarterback eventually needs to kind of look the same, right? I know there was a video that you did on the YouTube page for PFF where you talked about though how elite quarterbacks do share a number of similarities from a mechanic standpoint. So what are kind of those like foundational things that you do have to have that are kind of a little bit more non-negotiable from a mechanic standpoint? And then, you know, what are some things that can maybe be a little bit more individual flavor?
Did you guys hear the cat in the background?
Nope.
Now you're good.
Okay. Can you chop that up and I can just start over?
Oh no, I'm gonna leave it in. And I'm gonna go ahead and float the idea that you're a cat murderer. I mean, that's the only conclusion I can draw here.
Gosh, dang it! I should just roll with it. But as my fiance's got a cat, and, like it's actually meowing at the door. So that's
I know that cat life, you know
how it is. Yeah, no, I think there definitely is a lot of similarities between what the best guys are doing mechanically. You know, you look at the upper body, all of them kind of stay on a level plane. Their shoulders are not dipping up and down, but they're staying, you know, basically on the exact same plane. Like if you got a bucket of water on your head, a lot of them can stay so steady with their head and their shoulders that they're just rotating through. And then another commonality is just with their left arm. If their left arm is and their left hand is finishing somewhere in front of their face, that means that they're square to the throw. They're not spinning out. A lot of quarterbacks, you know, can spin out with their left arm and then you know, end up kind of away from their body. They're trying to stay as tight as they possibly can. And some of them work on it. Some of them it's just a natural thing that they do. But that upper body commonality between you know, keeping your left shoulder and your left arm tight, finishing, staying shoulders level. And then obviously you got to have that kind of just natural whip arm that, that we see guys have, but, that's a huge part. And then, you know, the lower body, I think is something that a lot of guys just never, you know, never learned when you're growing up. And then you kind of get a feeling maybe later on in life, you know, you play a lot of golf or something and you kind of just like, hey, if I just snap my, you know, right hip all the way through and try to get my belly button to the target, you know, my lower body's syncing up with my upper body. So I think it all ties in together, but a lot of the upper body mechanics, you know, the majority of the guys, you see it with Garoppolo, obviously he's watched Tom Brady for the longest time, but he is very, very tight with his left arm, keeping it in and just keeps everything compact and kind of keeps you in that, you know, almost like a figure skater. You want to be tight if they're spinning all the way around to spin as fast as they can. Same thing mechanically. Those guys want to stay as tight as they can.
What do you think is the most difficult throw for a quarterback when it comes to their mechanics? In other words, what throw must you be mechanically sound in order to successfully hit repeatedly?
That's a good question. I would say a lot of it is the anything to your backside. So for a right-hander, throwing any ball that needs velocity, I would say over 15 yards to your left side for right-handers, outside the numbers. So if there's, you know, you can, your footwork has to be ideal. You got to be lined up with your back foot to the throw, and you can really get exposed, you know, by leaving a ball. A lot of those throws to your left side get left inside, you know, on a lot of plays. So I would say that's one where if you're not all synced up and you're not throwing that thing good, you know, you can leave a ball inside. It can lead to a pick. But the left side outbreakers, 15 yards plus, you know, really that 12 to 18, 20 yard range where you got to put a lot of zip on it. I think those are toughest ones.
Cool. So I mean, even kind of tying that back to Garoppolo, right. And kind of the struggles that he had on the deep ball there, I guess on the flip side of that, is it more of a depth issue when you talk about throws that you can kind of get away with mechanics that aren't really ideal, right? Whether that's due to, you know, pressure and guys falling around you and you don't have the space to be able to do that or whatever the reason may be. Is it more of a depth thing where like those intermediate throws, you can get away with mechanics that aren't perfect, but the further downfield you get, kind of the more those things need to be on point?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's, you know, the depth of it. And then also, you know, is it on the hash? Is it in between the hashes, in between the numbers? Is it in that area to where you can kind of just flick it out and not be completely perfect with your feet or nothing set? I think that's where a lot of guys, you know, can still have success, where you're not having to fire something outside the numbers without perfect mechanics. You know, the in between the numbers stuff, you can typically kind of get away with something not being exactly perfect.
All right, so let's talk a bit more about evaluating quarterback play specifically. When you're looking at a quarterback's tape, give us the cliff notes of what you're looking for when you're saying that was a good quarterback play or that was not a good quarterback play.
Yeah, I think, you know, going back to, we talked about the rhythm of the offense, and I think, you know, in terms of what they're seeing pre-snap, you know, we talked about how often you go to your first read. You know, the guy's got to be able to see what's going on pre-snap and what his eyes are doing. You know, you saw Josh Allen, for example, last season, you know, his eyes would be all over the place, really, in his drop, and it could be quick game, it could be an intermediate concept, but you could just tell his eyes were not in the right spot a lot of the time. So you kind of looked at that. Most importantly, are they throwing to the open guy and are they throwing it accurately? But, you know, a lot of the times when I'm first looking at a guy, I'm trying to look at like just his overall instincts, because, there's a lot of guys that can look good in a clean pocket and everything's all good going to their first read. A lot of these college guys, you know, especially are throwing a ton to their first read. So, you kind of want to look past that, see how if they are forced to feel the pocket on a certain play and maybe find a second and third option. And, I love the plays that the guys find the check down. I know as boring as that sounds, it's like, man, that's a good NFL play right there. You see the best guys that are able to do it. So, there's certainly a lot that you can look at in one play, but I think if I'm looking right off the bat, I'm like, okay, where's this guy's instincts? How are his eyes working? And, you know, is he finding the open guy consistently?
So is there anything that you can, any tip or trick that you can give the average NFL watcher to help them figure out how to figure out what's going on between a quarterback's ears? Because we know that the position is a lot of times decided based on decision-making and quality of decision-making. And sometimes it's really difficult to pick up on when you're just watching, whether it be TV tape or even if you do have Game Pass, sometimes you don't know what you're looking at. So sure. Is there a way or a tip or just something where you're like, you know what, if you can focus on this thing, that will help you figure out kind of their decision-making and work through it?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I think it's a good, very fair question, because, you know, separating quarterback play and evaluating quarterback play for the longest time, obviously it's been very tough. But I think if you can look at their feet and, you know, see if they're throwing kind of in rhythm, if they're throwing on, you know, one hitch, and if they're throwing on the first or second hitch and they're throwing consistently to open guys, then you could be getting some good play calls matched up with the defense, but that means that you're seeing the game well. And so I think looking at the quarterback's feet a lot and just, do they get a little jittery after he sees something happen on the right side of the field that he's not expecting? And then he gets back to the middle of the field and he's, you know, the feet are just kind of not as calm. So I think that's definitely a good tell is just the rhythm of the feet. Once he hits the top of the drop, does he take one hitch and then he's finding the open guy? Does he take a second hitch? And then anything after that is kind of not quite an extend the play, but, you know, you're expected to find a guy or make a play on that, you know, third and fourth hitch.
So we've kind of touched on it a couple times just a little bit here in terms of, you know, mentioned how often quarterbacks are really actually going to their first look and you know, relatively how less that they're actually moving on and finding that second or third guy kind of in the progression. I think there is a lot of misunderstanding you know, about how quarterbacks' progressions work, right? And how often they're actually moving to that second and third guy. I mean, this was a thing that we dealt with in Ninerland with Colin Kaepernick for the longest time, right? Where it was basically he was a one-read guy and people would throw that out without not really understanding kind of what that term was implying. So I think what exactly, if you can, you know, strap the helmet on again and walk us kind of through what a quarterback is looking for on the field from the time they communicate that play call to the time they release the ball. What are they focused on? What are they looking at from the defense? Like, how are they, I guess, determining where they're ultimately going to throw that ball?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think, you know, you start off with, first of all, you want to make sure your guys are lined up. So you call a play. You kind of get a preliminary look at the defense, and you're mostly just looking at the safeties. Okay, are they in a two high shell? Are they showing single high? Okay, I got a preliminary look at the safeties, glancing, seeing kind of the corners, the front of the defense, while I'm seeing and making sure your guys are obviously set there. And then as you're getting ready to snap the ball, you know, depending on the play call, the best offenses are ones that aren't considered shell reads. And so shell reads meaning if it's two high, I'm going to this side of the field. If it's one high, I'm going to this side of the field. And that's kind of the term where you're saying, hey, he's a one read guy. A lot of the teams are know that he can't, you know, progress through. And so they make more shell reads to where they're saying, okay, we're cutting the field down. And if it's single high, you're going to go here. If it's two high, you're going here. And make it as simple as possible that way. The best offenses and the best quarterbacks are the ones where you can have true across the board, right to left reads. And those reads are, if you got a guy that can do it and he can come up to the line of scrimmage and he can say, okay, I'm starting here and I can maybe eliminate one of these guys just based on pre-snap leverage, then I'm an advantage. And then I can just click through my progression, you know, based on how tight the coverage is to the next guy. But I got, basically, if I start on the right side of the field, I know I got everybody from the left side coming into my vision to where I can go, you know, right to middle to left to check down. And that's a lot of the West Coast offense in terms of what that is. But, you know, you find out the shell of the defense, what the defensive safeties are doing. And then after the snap, if it's a true shell read where you're reading one side, basically you end up reading one guy and then you're making your decision off of that guy. If it's a true across the board, you know, Jay Gruden used to say, you know, right to left on your radio dial, left to right on your radio dial. Those are, you know, those are the best plays if you've got a guy that can do it, because you really got every receiver is viable option on each play.
With those full progressions, right? So say you have a situation where you are looking to go 1 to 2 to 3, maybe across the entire field. As a quarterback, I guess, at least in your experience, right, in this West Coast system, are you mostly focused on the receiver? So are you actually going from your guy, right, receiver number one to receiver number two? Or are you focused more so on like maybe a specific key defender and their leverage? Or what are you like looking at specifically to determine whether you're going to go to that first read or move on to two and three?
Yeah, man, you guys got some great questions. But this is you can ask a bunch of different guys. I think that a lot of guys would say that they're looking at, you know, defenders strictly and just kind of feeling their guy. The best way that I've heard it, you know, preached to me is just see your spots. So you're seeing the spot. You know that your eyes are going to that spot, but you're not necessarily just focused in on just the defender to where he backs up, and then you got to try to recalibrate and find where your receiver's at. So I think the best guys can just, you know, get their eyes in that spot and then just have a really good understanding of, okay, I need to move on. And if I move on, am I doing it smoothly? Is kind of the key thing. So, seeing your spots is a good way to put it. There are certainly reads where you're just going to look at the defender, and you know he backs up right away, and you'll just naturally kind of have your guy that comes into your vision. But you know, if you're kind of looking at it just big picture, what to do, I would just say, you know, see your spots and kind of feel both guys at the same time.
All right, I think in terms of questions, that's most of the stuff we've got. I want to move on to the fun stuff. Let's move on to the lightning round.
That wasn't Sweet. The fun stuff?
Man, you know I love me some lightning rounds. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love hearing about how Texas' defense is great and all, but let's get to the fun stuff. All right, so we're going to ask you just like maybe 5 or 6 or like 15 questions. Give me the first thing that comes to mind. Like, don't think gut instinct. You know, like if I say cat or dog, you say...
Dog.
Yeah, exactly, because you murder cats, right?
Yes.
Like, that's...
Yeah. Oh, God. All right.
All right, so off the top, rank 1 to 4 the NFC West QBs. Go.
Russell Wilson, Jimmy Garoppolo, whoever is in Arizona. Who am I missing here?
Jared Goff.
I would say Goff, whoever's in Arizona.
Yeah. There's a reason you forgot Jared Goff. Number 2, you're starting a franchise with a quarterback under 27. Who do you choose?
Under 27, I'm going to go Patrick Mahomes.
Oh, man, look at that.
Your guy, yeah.
Look at that.
Yeah, I just want to see the excitement, the Brett Favre factor. We might have some ugly ones in there, but, man, I need some excitement. So I'm going Patrick Mahomes.
Hot damn. All right. Best non-Stillwater stadium that you've played in?
Oof. I would say Texas A&M, Kyle Field. I do not really like their fans, but I think they can be a little obnoxious, but
a little,
the game day atmosphere there is, it's a pretty cool place,
man. I'm married into a family of Aggies, so I feel your pain. I feel your pain.
I'm sorry about that.
I know it happens. Nobody's perfect, right? Best burger you've ever had?
Best burger. I'm going to go with Shake Shack. I like Shake Shack. I'm going like big. I know it's not a, you know, family run place or anything, small town, but I'm going to go Shake Shack. That I used to live at that place in Dallas. So,
all right. Give me your World Cup favorite.
World Cup favorite. I haven't been watching. Did Belgium win today?
Spoiler no. alert in case anyone, well, David ruined it. No
spoiler alert. If you're yeah. Not, yeah, it's fine. that was my 538 quiz pick team. That was the only way that I could have a rooting interest.
Yep. He even learned right. Belgian for yeah. like one text. It was great. All right. Yeah. Give me one word for Tom Brady's quarterback room.
One word. Tom.
Oh man.
It's all about Tom in there.
Yeah. Give me, is there any like Fair. Interesting factoid about that quarterback room and how it's different than any other one?
Man, I was a rookie and I just like was trying to find my way. I would just say like high level intelligence. Cause when I was a rookie in there and you know, you're not spending time on day one install stuff. You're looking at like, what are the Jets going to be doing in week 12? Like what blitzes are we got to prepare for? So it was Bill O'Brien in there and Brady and then Hoyer and myself were in there just kind of like, nodding along, you know, like, yeah, no, we're with you, but they're talking high level protection and what plays they're going to run in like week 12 of that season. We're talking, this was like in, you know, May, June OTA. So, it was pretty interesting, man.
The benefit of consistency, man.
Yeah.
We're enjoying a little bit of that right now. We have a second year head coach, you know, so
right. Been a while since that.
Yeah. So most difficult defense you've prepared for?
Oof, in the NFL?
Give me college or the NFL, either one.
College, I would say Texas that year that we've already talked about. They did some good like just kind of match coverages where they weren't just spot drop into zones and they would pattern match and match up with you and then they'd play cover one and they just had better players. So I would say that. And then, gosh, we played the Texans a couple of years when, you know, JJ Watt was coming and they had, they've always had good schemes down there with, you know, whether they had Wade Phillips or whoever they had those playoff years. The Texans were always just kind of one where you look and you're like, man, they're not giving up many easy throws. And, you know, they when I was in Cincinnati, we had back-to-back playoffs years there, and it was tough to get anything going against them. They're a good team.
All right, and then you've talked a lot about how you've learned. You mentioned Bill O'Brien and Ken Zampezi, people you've learned a lot from. What's the one thing that they taught you about quarterbacking that you still think about to this day?
Man, good question. I would say a lot of it's just like, just trust what you see and let it rip. You know, don't try to make this thing overcomplicated. Ken Zampezi would always say, hey, it's better to be decisive than right. And that's definitely something that kind of, you know, I coach some quarterbacks on the side, and same exact thing, man. Just trust what you're seeing and let it rip, because if there's any hesitation, it's usually not going to be good.
All right. And then final question, give me your record prediction for the Niners this year.
Record prediction for the Niners. I'm going to say 10-6.
Yeah, that's right.
What do you think? Is that good?
Yeah. I mean, I think we still have to do like the whole like ramp up to the season and training camp and injuries and everything. But I feel like 8-8, 9-7 is right in that area where I'm feeling good about the team. I think if they can steal a couple games, they get up to 10. But I think, you know, if they don't win more than 6 or 7 games, I think it'll be a disappointment.
Yeah, I mean, 9 wins, give or take, is I feel like kind of where you're at with them. And I think really that ceiling, they need that defense, you know, the young guys that they have on that defense to develop, and that'll help them out a lot. But yeah, I think that's like right in the ballpark for sure.
Yeah, if Richard Sherman comes back to All-Pro Richard, or even close to All-Pro Richard Sherman, if he comes back to like Pro Bowl Richard Sherman, you know,
I mean, he could just be Richard Sherman and on the field, and that's probably an improvement from Dante Johnson. So, I mean, it'll be all right. I think he's the least of my worries at this point. They need guys like Witherspoon and Colbert and all these young dudes to be able to actually
step
up and develop.
Solomon Thomas, yeah, big one.
That's my dude. All right, well, hey, thanks a lot for coming on. Thanks a lot for sharing all your nuggets of wisdom and for reliving the painful memory that was that Texas game. Really appreciate it.
it was fun, fellas. I appreciate you guys having me on.
Awesome, man. Thanks. All right, David. Biggest takeaway from the interview with Zach?
Oh, man. I think it's there was a lot. It's hard to pick out one thing. You know, I think a lot of the stuff that he talked about as far as like the processing elements, right? And really kind of what quarterbacks are looking for. Cause I think that's so important, right? If you're an outsider who's never been a quarterback or, you know, never played at a high level and haven't studied like what these guys are doing, having some things that you can kind of visually cue in on when you're watching these games, or you know, even just having a general idea, even if it's not going to get you to the right spot every single snap, having a general idea of what these guys are looking at and what their thought process is out on the field, I think is so important. And you have to have kind of at least a basic understanding there to try and evaluate these guys. So I thought that stuff was great.
Yeah, I thought I was really intrigued by just the concept of what the expectation is for an NFL quarterback nowadays, where you're expected to be able to literally throw on a dime, throw in a spot, and not move much. That's now base level expectation for quarterback play. I don't know that very many quarterbacks can do that very well.
Yeah, I think, you know, that expectation is not right what gets you in the door as an NFL quarterback, right? It's like, what am I doing to perform and actually help my team, right? And kind of looking at it from that lens is great, because like we mentioned, you know, during the interview, it's tough, you know, especially if you're not watching all of these quarterbacks play and you're used to shitty quarterback play like we've had in San Francisco forever. It's very easy to kind of think that some stuff that is a little bit more expected and kind of basic is just like this otherworldly stuff, because we haven't had anybody that can perform at that level. So that was definitely helpful.
Yeah. Also, another Shake Shack fan. That seems
nothing wrong with Shake Shack at all.
I mean, they do serve beer there, which I appreciate.
Yeah. Any burger place that can get me beer, and, you know, the burger's like not terrible by any means. They got pretty solid fries too.
Their burger's not terrible. I want to create like a burger ranking, because we've got a lot of fans who are like, In-N-Out's amazing.
I know get like, there's like the more fast foodie ones that gets right. It's the In-N-Out, the Five Guys that drives
tiers.
everybody crazy. Burger tiers.
There are burger tiers.
There are definitely burger tiers.
And I mean, TIERS, not like burger tiers, because that would be a whole different kind of tier.
I mean, hopefully whatever burger you're eating isn't.
When I don't eat burgers, I cry tears, and they are burger tears.
There you go.
Yep. Thanks for tuning in for the slightly delayed, I guess, interview episode of the Scheme Month. This is week 2 of Scheme Month. We're going to try and do another episode this week, but if we can't and have to reschedule, then we'll come back next week with our defensive-focused smart football episode, and we'll talk a little bit about Robert Saleh and some things that we look for schematically when thinking about what he's going to do next year on defense. So thanks again for tuning in. You can always follow me at Better Rivals. David, where can they follow you?
That's going to be at Newman NFL.
You can always get our merch at TeePublic. Find my Twitter page, quiz from the last section, about where to find that and get the link, get your t-shirts. They're all the way in Brazil now. All the way in Brazil. No one's going to understand what that about to throw up t-shirt means in Brazil. But I love it nonetheless. But that dude is it's rocking amazing. It hard. So thanks again for tuning in. And as always, go Niners.
Hey, I'm Anil Dash, and I'm the host of a new show called Function from the Vox Media Podcast Network and Glitch. This season, we're talking with experts about why our voting machines are so bad and how that might hurt our elections. We'll also talk with an animator to find out how popular dances from the real world end up in video games. And we're going to tackle the biggest question in tech. Why do so many celebrities use screenshots from that Apple Notes app to make their public apologies when they screw up? You can find new episodes of Function every Monday on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And thanks to Microsoft Azure for sponsoring Function.
Most of the time, we talk about tech in terms of a handful of gigantic companies, like Google, Meta, and Apple. But some of the most interesting stuff we find online is the product of a single person.
When you're working on your own, I think there's this beauty of being able to come up with an idea and then implement it then in that moment. You don't have to have permission from someone else. There's no red tape.
In the Vergecast series, Solo Acts, we'll get to know these people, the tech they use to get stuff done, and the obstacles they face trying to compete with the giants.
Some people that I talk to and my friends are like, you know, your competitors are Zuckerberg and Musk. Like, aren't you kind of like afraid of that?
Every Monday, our friend Ashley Esqueda will be curating and hosting these interviews and sharing with us what she's learned.
I can't believe the McRib locator was originally a tornado locator.
Right.
Pretty wild.
Listen to our Solo Acts miniseries now in the Vergecast feed, anywhere you find podcasts.
Hello, I'm Neelai Patel, the editor-in-chief of The Verge and host of Decoder, a business podcast where I interview CEOs about big ideas, the problems that come from those ideas, and how they make decisions. It is also surprisingly about org charts. It comes up a lot. We're launching a new limited series that we're calling the Centennial Series, where I talk to CEOs of companies that are over 100 years old, like Xerox, Barnes & Noble, and more. There's no 100-year-old company that's without its struggles, and it's been fascinating to talk to these CEOs about which parts of these companies' history are important and which parts they can let go. A little spoiler for you, if a company is over 100 years old, there's a lot of drama to talk about. It's been a good time. You can listen to the Centennial Series right in the Decoder feed. New episodes of Decoder are out on Tuesday, and the Centennial Series is out on Thursdays. Check it out. We think you're really going to like it. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts.